This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Tree Lin. Abu Sayyaf has conducted kidnappings, bombings and battles with soldiers for more than 20 years in the southern Philippines. In March, four sailors from Malaysia were abducted off the eastern coast of Sabah, a maritime region which Indonesia's chief security minister warned could become a new Somalia. The terror group has threatened to behead these Malaysian hostages if their ransom demands are not met. And joining me in the studio today to explain the increasingly aggressive acts of Abu Sayyaf as well as their larger aspirations is Aruna Gopinath, Professor of Politics and International Relations at the National Defense University. Professor, remind us who Abu Sayyaf are and what they want.
Okay. Now, if you look at the whole scenario in Mindanao, this separatist movement started with the Moro National Liberation Front. That was in the late 70s, and it was headed by Noor Miswari then. But the main aim was basically to get a separate state, you know, and fighting for self-determination. So when they, his ideas were very noble in that sense because of the differences between what was happening in the Christian majority areas vis-a-vis the Muslim majority areas, because these areas were totally neglected. So what he wanted was just a good, life for all the Muslims in the areas. However, you notice that the Philippine government was not for separatism at all. The maximum that they said they could give was autonomy. And that is when, because of ideological differences, you find in the 1980s there was a split in the MNLF. And that broke into what was known as the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or the MILF, headed by Ashim Salamat. Now, his one, because he was basically using Islamic teachings, he said it was basically for Muslims and, going along the lines of still separatism. But, of course, Philippine government disagreed. Meanwhile, you notice, because of the ideological differences and because when they see money, they want more of it, you find many of these groups become, they break up. They become more and more splinter groups. So as a result, you notice in 1990, you find that it was this Abu Sayyaf was a split off from the MILF. And it was headed by a young man, a 20-year-old, Abdul Razak Janjalani. And then he was, of course, educated in the Middle East, and when he come back, they have got all these fresh ideas. And he had very close relations with Osama bin Laden. And as a result, they thought, Southeast Asia can become the hub of their teachings. And, they get more of their followers, in these areas. And that is how it started off. But then you find, as it picked up, it has grown today. More splits have come. You have got the BIFF, the Raja Soleiman group, and every now and then you'll find new teams coming up. So the Abu Sayyaf is only one, we can say, the biggest notorious group that has evolved in South Philippines.
But there are others.
Yes, definitely.
In 2014, President Benigno Aquino vowed to crush Abu Sayyaf after the terror group kidnapped a group of foreign citizens and killed six soldiers. But last month, so 2 years on now, the group killed 18 soldiers. Has the problem gotten worse?
Of course. If you see the whole picture from 1990s onward, I will say, the situation has become so bad after the Abu Sayyaf came in, because it is a spate of killings everywhere, kidnappings, and without any reason. And basically, they want money, ransom, kidnap, kidnappings, and then it's a ransom. So evidently, you find all the rich people will be targeted. And even if you notice, tourists also are targeted. And they've even gone to Sabah. And you notice, all those who are going there on a holiday also get targeted. So as a result, it's the ransom that they're looking for, money. And everything is now in US dollars. If you are a Filipino, yes, it is in Philippine pesos. But otherwise, it's all in US dollars. And so, if they now they've become even more notorious in the sense that if you don't pay them what they demand, now it is killing.
Is there a reason why each splinter group and each of its factions, I suppose, have become increasingly aggressive? You know, is it just money that's the driving factor behind this?
One is money. The other is also they want fame. They feel they can prove to the world that they are a group to be reckoned with. Because after they have joined up with the IS, you know, they feel they are now the leaders in Southeast Asia. So being leaders, they are able to recruit as many people into the fold and link up with the IS. At the same time, to prove that they will be able to establish the caliphate in Southeast Asia. So the aim is now establishing the caliphate. You know, whether you like it or not, it's, you know, they're all out for it.
Considering that this has been a problem for more than 20 years and there have been negotiations with the government of the Philippines, what have current and past Filipino governments been doing wrong?
If you ask me what they have been doing wrong, actually, we can go back to the Marcos era. Marcos started this whole thing, you know, or even earlier in 1930s itself, when President Quezon was then the president of the Commonwealth, you find that he was the first president who sent the large number of Christians into Mindanao, and because he wanted the Christians also to dominate those areas. But when Marcos came in, it became very, very evident that, you know, he was discriminating, you know, the Muslims from the Christians. Because in the Christian areas, if you go in Davao City and all that, there's development. You know, it is like a real huge town with lots of developments, malls and name, whatever you can think of. Everything is there. But go to the Muslim areas. There's no drinking water, no roads, you know, and people are left in the lurch, you know. And so you can see the comparison. So definitely they feel the pinch. And that is why they wanted to overthrow the government, you know, from time to time. Negotiations, yes. Mrs. Aquino was the first person to go to Jolo to try to come to a
reconciliation. Yeah.
Yes, to reconcile the differences. However, you find that you know, it was she was able to do it with Noor Miswari. So when the peace process came in 1996, when Ramos was the president. They established what was known as the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao. It was already there. And Miswari became the first governor. But what is wrong in Muslim Mindanao, I would say, is that there is no unity among the Muslims. There are 13 groups. And all of them are divided along linguistic and ethnic lines. So this is where you find, because Miswari was a Tausug, the Maranaos, the Maguindanaos didn't work with him. See, instead of thinking he's also a Moro, they didn't look at it at that way. They felt he's a Tausug. So even today, that is the pressing problem among the Muslims. So for the Philippine government, it is very difficult to identify which group they can deal with. And that is why you find eventually they had to settle for the MILF, you know. So the MILF is now like the group that they deal with as far as the peace process is concerned. And Abu Sayyaf definitely is not brought to the negotiating table. And this is why you find there's, you know, in the long run, a spate of killings and discontentment. You know, it's like showing the government, like, you know, they can do what they want, but they are definitely, this group is definitely not going to toe the lines. You see, last year, January, in the Mama Pasano tragedy, 54 officers from the Philippine Armed Forces were shot. And that itself has derailed the system today, you know.
When we say that the government has settled on the MILF as a group that can be negotiated with, but can the MILF actually represent people's interests? I mean, when peace deals are brokered, when discussions are had, do people feel like, yes, I feel represented, I feel like you are capable of representing me?
No, that is where the mistake was done. Mm. Because you see, MILF is only one group, although they're the majority. But still, you see, there are so many splinters. For me, I would think that if there's a negotiation, all of them should be represented. You know, at least one representative from each group should come in. So at least they feel, you know, there is some recognition given to them. And only then, you know, at the negotiating table, all the differences can be, underlined. But when you only deal with one specific group, then you see you are, you know, not allowing the others to move in. And so this, they feel, has been the major obstacle in the negotiation panel.
I'm sitting in today with Professor Dr. Aruna Gopinath, Professor of Politics and International Relations at the National Defense University. We're discussing terrorism in the Philippines. Up next, we talk about peace deals that have been made, as well as how much Abu Sayyaf is influenced by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I am Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Aruna Gopinath, Professor of Politics and International Relations at the National Defense University. And Professor Aruna is discussing terrorism in the Philippines. Now, we were talking about how the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or the MILF, has become kind of the go-to group for negotiations with the Filipino government. And there was a peace deal that was signed in 2012, a deal which was brokered by PM Najib Razak. What is the status of that deal? Has it been jeopardized by Abu Sayyaf?
Definitely, because when the Mamapasano tragedy took place last year, that is showed was an indication that they are not in favor of the law, the basic law, you know, and there's supposed to be like a referendum where the people are supposed to sort of vote in to see whether, you know, that'll be good coming up. Every time if you notice there's some development, they will derail the system by either bombings, you know, or killings. And so nothing works out. Like you see, when Mindanao was part of, the ASEAN countries wanted Mindanao to be part of the East Asia, the gate to East Asia and Southeast Asia. But you see what has happened. Malaysia went in, Singapore went in, Brunei went in by pumping in money. And we started developments. There were lots of buildings coming up, you know, transportation system, everything they worked in. But immediately, you know, these groups began to stop them by, you know, having bombings all over the place. So it is still hanging. Nothing can be carried out. So you find that every time some good intention comes in, it's not able to progress. So the same thing happened 2012. This law has come in, you know, and they hoped at least giving them 2 years for them to understand and then set up something. And then hopefully they, you know, they finally can come to the final agreement where peace is given to them. But with all these problems and the extortion and kidnappings and beheading, how do you think, you know, the Philippine government can ever, you know, render peace to them?
Underpinning that peace deal, as well as much of our discussion that's come before, is the Bangsa Moro Law. Can you tell us what this law entails and where Abu Sayyaf fits within this?
See, the Bangsa Moro Law actually is the part of this basic law that's supposed to be, you know, a part of the peace deal. It's basically to ensure that all the 13 groups will work together, you know, including the highland tribes, you know, all of them will have some access to the peace deal, and they must all feel proud that finally peace is coming into their land, and they will all be able to develop that particular areas that they live in. But today, the major factor has been money, you know, because now the Abu Sayyaf feel they are the richest group, you know, with all the extortions that they're getting. But you see, when they try to put forward the deals and the demands, which is simply atrocious, the Philippine government cannot condone to this, you know.
So there is, in other words, there is an impasse.
Yes, I would say that, yes.
Rodrigo Duterte, the president-elect, like the current president, has vowed to crush Abu Sayyaf before his term ends. Do you think President Duterte would approach the Abu Sayyaf problem differently?
I think so. Maybe giving him a chance, I think he may take a different approach. But I think he's also a very, very aggressive person. If they don't listen to him, he may also crush them, like what the Americans have done. Sometimes, in order to, you know, to make sure that these people don't become too volatile, you have to go all out and crush them. So I think Duterte may take a stand where he thinks he will have a negotiation first with all the groups, but because he's from the south, so he knows, you know, what their frame, the frames, the mind is. However, if it doesn't work, I think he will take the offensive.
And is that a good idea in your opinion?
Why not? Because when people are dying and killing and they're doing everything that's so disastrous, I think even the civilians, what did the civilians do? You know, and they're just beheading everyone. I think they should, do something about this.
While we're talking about civilians, the beheading of John Ridsdale, the Canadian hostage, was filmed and uploaded on the internet, which is something that we're seeing a lot in terms of terrorist promotion, I suppose, nowadays. How much is Abu Sayyaf influenced by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda?
Yes, of course, greatly, I would say. Because last time, they never did this. Beheading was only the last resort, you know. And they never wanted to do that. Because if you go back to the teachings of Islam, there's no such thing that you have to, behead someone in order to get their money. But here, you see, the true teachings of Islam is not propagated. That is why we are having so much of trouble there. So you find that for them, beheading now is to instill fear in the public and in the nations, that if you don't listen to their demands, then of course this is what the ultimate is going to be. And now they've come up with a weapon called, rainbow knife, which is so sharp, it's like a sickle, and it just, they just slice your neck. It just comes up very fast. So they say it's painless death.
I doubt it.
So painless. You only feel the pain at the initial stage, then your head just comes out, So you see, they're coming out with all these tactics, and then they're just throwing it in plastic bags, the heads, and then they throw it all over the city to instill the fear. So for the IS, of course, this is very, it's a wonderful thing, because they feel that people are getting frightened and more of them will join the fold. But I think this is a wrong move.
Abu Sayyaf has also released videos proclaiming their allegiance to the Islamic State, aside from copying, I guess, in some ways, their tactics. Do we know if they're receiving support or funding from IS?
IS is not only the group that's funding them, because initially we found that they've got lots of money, from groups who want the separatism. And, it runs into millions. It's all in US dollars. And they've got the weapons also today, So, like when I was there in the South and all, I've gone through areas where youngsters, only 18, 19, 20, having this exercises, shootouts, with real bullets, to make sure that they get the targets. And I had to be ducked. They had to push me down. Otherwise, I would have been a victim myself. So things like this, they are now very rich, considered to be very rich. But the only thing now what they want, like the IS, is to get access to nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, which means once they get nuclear weapons, they control the world.
And that access comes from, and we keep circling back to this, but that access comes from money. And is it fair to say that the bulk of the money is still coming from ransoms?
Ransom is only one. But there are also like big, big philanthropists, in the Middle East and among the IS supporters who also give them.
With that said, there are four Malaysian hostages in captivity who were kidnapped from Sabah. We're not sure how much is being demanded. But as a country, do we have a history of giving in to ransom?
We try not to. But when it is death that is pronounced, we don't want our citizens also to be taken away. Bernard Tan was, beheaded, and we never expected that. You see, the negotiation, normally during the negotiation, they will at least agree to the amount that we also come to. But when nowadays, it is not the amount that we dictate, it is what they dictate. So if you don't follow their footsteps, that's it. So we are very careful now, when it comes to, doing the negotiation as far as the money is concerned. But definitely it's all above $3 million US dollars.
There is an argument put forth by some that, countries should not give in to ransom, that you should not give in to terrorists. From your perspective, as somebody who has done field work, as somebody who understands what's happening, what is best for us in terms of not just our, I mean, as citizens, obviously, giving the ransom would probably be best. We would want to know that our country would come for us. But from a country's perspective, what's best?
You see, it's very hard to discuss issues with these kind of characters who don't have the minds to think properly. You see, they've been so used to notorious acts. So sometimes for notoriety, you have to also, you know, deal with them in the same manner, you know. Ransom, because when somebody's life is threatened, we have no other choice. That is why we are giving the money, you know, because he's a citizen of our state. But if, you know, we feel like some countries say it doesn't matter, let the beheading go on, you know, but we will take further action, then you must take military action, right? Immediate military action must be taken to wipe out these guys. What surprises me is that we have countries in the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Countries. Why aren't they doing anything? You know, that is my question. Because I'm sure if they took a stand and they tried to come and speak to these people and tell them, look, you know, in Islam, it's not like this. And can't we do things in a better fashion or, you know, more peaceful? Don't you think that they will listen? See, I feel that, you know, the bigger people in the OIC should come down, you know, and talk to them and tell them, you know, let's stop this, but let us take another avenue.
This is not how you establish a caliphate.
Exactly. Because if you go back to the ancient times and you go back to history and understand what the caliphate is so different from what these people are doing.
You referenced your work earlier, and you're the first Malaysian woman to have conducted fieldwork in the rebel-controlled territories of the southern Philippines. How much has the situation evolved in the decades since then on the ground?
Yes, I was there from 1979, I would say. I was very lucky in those days. It was much easier for me to have access because I worked with the constabulary and then also went to the jungles to interview them. Of course, three times I almost lost my life because, you know, when I asked the questions like, sitting like this, you know, I'm at gunpoint. So the moment I make one shift of the question, I will be poked, you know, to make sure that I still stay in line with what I'm discussing. At that point, I would say that when I interviewed Ms. Wari and Hashim Salamat, I was telling them as a researcher because I wanted to find out what exactly was wrong and how I could explain this to the world. And Ms. Wari was very happy. He said, yes, please talk about us to the world. Because they had no notion at that time of all this beheading and kidnapping and all. They just wanted separatism and they just wanted their rights for self-determination.
Sovereignty,
yes,
in some
that's
ways.
That's all. That's all they wanted, you know. So definitely I went in on those lines. But over the years, when 1990s, late 90s, and then 2000 and all, when this Abu Sayyaf became very popular, certain areas I can't go. Basilan today, I can't go because I almost got abducted at one point when my friend, my Filipino friend and I were supposed to go there for an interview. And apparently we were supposed to take the ferry to cross over. And that evening we were supposed to go, but she said, never mind, let me go first because I had somebody wanting to do an interview with me in the, you know, at the radio station. So I said, okay, I'll join you in the morning. In the ferry, she saw a man who was very friendly with her, and apparently he was an Abu Sayyaf defector. So she thought she could get all the information from him and then go with him, and he said he will guide her. But once they landed, she was caught, kidnapped, house arrest for 90 days. So, and they only gave her two bananas three times a day with one glass of water. She was to sleep on the cement floor. So I thought, luckily God was on my side. Otherwise, I would have faced the same fate like what my friend did. And she was there for almost 90 days. Then a Filipino congressman gave 3 million pesos and she was able to be released. But in my case, it wouldn't have been 3 million pesos, it would have been 3.5 million US dollars.
Because you're not Filipino.
Yes, because I'm a foreigner. So, and they could have been more nasty to me. They would have cut my fingers or my head or whatever to show the world that, you know, so much for research.
So now it's not possible to do the work that you did then?
I don't think so. I can go into all these areas. That's why people are very scared to, you know, even delve into this kind of dangerous areas. Maximum, you see, we can talk to the defectors. But even the defectors, maximum, they will only give us about 2 months. After that, they go back because they cannot associate themselves and come back to society. So they say, you know, we'd rather go back. So even the defectors, I wonder how much what they say is the truth.
Is de-radicalization and rehabilitation part of the Philippines' anti-terrorist strategy?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Because all countries today, ASEAN countries, we are working towards that, you know, with the U.S. We are hoping that radicalization and, you know, coming up with the programs where they can come back to society. Some of them have showed or expressed their views that they want to be part of society. But majority... I don't think they can come because they've been so long in the jungle, they feel they've been cut off from society. So it'll take time. It'll take time. And there are many Filipino organizations who have gone into the prisons where these people are arrested and kept, where they've been indoctrinated and showed how, you know, they become part of society and they be given, you know, various avenues. So I think it will take a longer process. But certainly I hope that is one method of how we can stop this.
We've been talking so far about people who are directly involved with these things, you know, people who are abducting, who are blowing things up, who are beheading people. But does the Filipino government also crack down on sympathizers, on people who study and write about them, people who, well, who would seem on the surface to be sympathizers?
We are only sympathetic up to a point. When somebody starts killing, I don't think we can be sympathetic to that person. You see, because, you see, you can face death, but on what grounds? You see, I mean, of course, sometimes you can be threatened. That is different. But when they really go all out to kill you.
Why am I dying?
Yes, yeah. That is not fair. So for the Philippine government, they are lucky that people like me and a few others who are doing the research have been giving them the information. You know, otherwise they cannot, you know, see what is happening in the deep jungles. Even for the Americans, you see, of course, no American can go there because they'll be chopped up, you know. So you find, or if not, their ransom will be terribly, you know, too high, you know. So for the government, they want to know the information. But then even the media who goes there, and then we also have some the USID, you know, groups there. But they can only go up to a certain point. Beyond that, it's not possible because they know that now these are the people giving information. So they will also target us now.
You know, right at the start of the interview, you talked about how if you look at the Muslim areas of the southern Philippines in the past, they, you know, no running water, they were living in poverty. And in the areas where the group operates now, nearly 2/3 of the population lives in poverty. Why do residents sympathize with the group? You know, is there a belief that, okay, once, you know, if they get what they want, we will get what we want?
The thing is, you know, the sympathizers also, you are right in one way because, you know, they also have like an interest, you know. They have an agenda also. Don't forget, we have so many RIDOs, R-I-D-O, who are leaders in that areas and who are filthy rich. Now, when you want to have a peace deal with the representatives, if your leader is bypassed, that's also not going to help. Now, building an infrastructure, say a road, cutting across provinces, you have to deal with all the RIDOs who are there. Otherwise, you can't build a road and leave it hanging, you know. So all of them have to compromise, and that's not working because the RIDOs don't see eye to eye over all these matters. So the question is, as sympathizers also, you know, they have an agenda, see? So they feel that, okay, if you win, we also get a portion of this. You see, it's a stake, you know, a stake in the holdings.
So how can conversations move forward in any sort of productive way then when you're facing, firstly, people who are not willing to listen because that's not, who are so radical that they're not going to listen anymore, or when you're dealing with people for whom their interests are so disparate that it's just a bunch of splinter groups?
You see, I feel that, you know... time should also be an answer, because when this old group fade away, the new groups, you know, because they also are watching, you know, they know what's happening in the world, they should have some interest of trying to solve the situation. Maybe they can become leaders themselves, but they should try to show that they are a better leader than their former one, you know, and try to ensure that they will provide more to their people than what the former leaders did. Because as I mentioned, there's no drinking water, no proper sanitation. Okay, do something for that, you know. So when you do something or looking into the development, then the people will say, yes, you know, these guys are much more better, rather than, you know, just kidnapping or ransom, going for ransom and then, you know, beheading. I don't think that serves as an answer to anyone.
Finally, looking from the Philippines to Malaysia, how are we coping in terms of border security?
You see, we have this big problem because our borders are all porous.
Yes.
You know, from Singapore right down to Thailand, you can go all the way without even being controlled. And that's the biggest problem we have faced. And the crossovers, you know, it's so easy. We are still having the barter trade with Philippines, Sabah and, you know, Philippines, Zamboanga, all these, because it's so easy. These speedboats just come across. They do their bargains and then they go back. Why are we allowing that? You know, I feel we should be very, very tight as far as border controls are concerned. Although we came with the Exome and we came out with so many new, you know, patrols, you know, trying to monitor. But still, it has not, you know, been successful 100%. So I think all this barter trade, you know, all this should be stopped. I don't think we need all this. You know, let us first solve our security problems first. And Philippine government should also do the same. Only then, if we think there's a need for further progress towards the trading, you know, which the thing the poorer groups may want to get, you know, involved in, we can arrange something for them. But I don't think this barter trade should continue anymore.
Thank you very much, Professor. I've been speaking with Professor Dr. Aruna Gopinath, Professor of Politics and International Relations at the National Defense University. And together we've been discussing Abu Sayyaf and terrorism in the Philippines. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.